I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The Baltimore club scene is now more than 20 years old, and it remains one of Baltimore's great musical calling cards across the country. There's a vibrant indie rock scene here, and festivals celebrating bluegrass and old-time music are increasingly popular. Today, a look at part of the classical music scene here in Charm City. As the General Assembly considers boosting the BSO's budget, perspectives on the challenges orchestras face from Fred Bronstein of the Peabody Institute and Tim Smith, the former classical music critic for the Baltimore Sun. Plus, opera is alive and well locally. The Maryland Opera Company continues its inaugural season on Sunday, while the Baltimore Concert Opera, going strong after 10 years, presents the local premiere of an opera based on the deep friendship between two Supreme Court justices. Midday on Music starts right after the news. And welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's Midday on Music. A little later in the show, a conversation about two opera companies that are strutting their stuff this weekend. We'll talk to James Harp and a young soprano named Colleen Daly about the inaugural season of the Maryland Opera Company, and the composer Derek Wang will tell us about his opera, Scalia Ginsburg, which gets its local premiere tonight with the Baltimore Concert Opera. But we begin today with a conversation about the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, the largest arts organization in the state of Maryland and one of only 17 full-time orchestras in the United States. So full-time means that the players of the BSO are hired for the full year with vacation and health benefits in accordance with a full-time job. Many orchestras around the country, including some in fairly large cities, hire their players for only 9 or 10 months a year. So whether or not the BSO will remain a full-time orchestra is at the heart of a contract dispute that's been going on between the players and the BSO management since last fall. Management of the orchestra points to the fact that the BSO has lost an average of $1.6 million per year for the past 10 years. Supporters of the BSO are crossing their fingers that the General Assembly will provide supplemental funding for the BSO. Final legislative approval of a bill that will provide an additional $3.2 million over the next 2 years may come today. This is in addition to the funds that the BSO is already scheduled to receive through its annual grant from the Maryland State Arts Council. By the way, this is a correction from a comment I made yesterday on the program. I was mistaken in saying that the BSO bill had already landed on the governor's desk. That is not the case. It has passed in the House, and it was voted out of a committee in the Senate yesterday, but a vote on the Senate floor is expected today. And we understand that the bill is named after John Merrill, who passed away from cancer last Sunday. John was a violinist in the Baltimore Symphony for 42 years before he retired a couple of years ago. We send our condolences to his wife, Julia, who has also played in the BSO at one time, and the Merrill family. In addition to its money woes, the BSO is also trying to address the lack of diversity in its ranks. In our majority black city, only one member of the orchestra is African American. These challenges are not unique to the Baltimore Symphony. For some perspective, we turn to Fred Bronstein, the dean of the Peabody Institute, and Tim Smith, the former classical music critic for the Baltimore Sun. It's good to see you both. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
And listeners, you can join us as well if you have thoughts about the fate of the BSO. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So Fred Bronstein, you came to Peabody a few years ago from the orchestra world. You were running the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. That's one of several orchestras over the last few years who have made a decision to reduce their season. This was at least at one point the suggestion by the BSO management to in the current contract negotiations. Talk about that process, why that decision was made, and what's your take on whether it's been successful there and whether it's something that should be considered here?
Well, I think that the first thing I would begin with is saying that, having managed orchestras in several cities, large orchestras, major orchestras, I will tell you that every city is different. Every situation is different. So you start from that premise. In the case of St. Louis, back in the early 2000s, they went through a period of looking at cost structure and at looking at resources, the development of new resources, what would it require to make the orchestra solvent and at the same time also sustainable. In that process, it was not an easy process, and that began, that predated my time there, actually, but where the orchestra ultimately ended up was 42 weeks. They've now gone to, I think they're up to 43 weeks, from a 52-week orchestra, and continued, you know, in the years that followed under the leadership of David Robertson and now Stefan Deneuve, to be a major orchestra, to tour internationally, to record, and to do everything that you would expect a quote-unquote 52-week-a-year orchestra to do.
Did the rollback include big pay cuts for the people who play?
So initially there were reductions. It was smoothed out with, you know, the arrangement. The contract was built around having summer pay so that there would be, it was reduced summer pay. But it was essentially 42 weeks, you know, of performance a year. And I would say that, you know, the orchestra, you know, once it adjusted to that, to that scenario, it never, the other thing I should say is at the other end of that was, you know, the belief by donors that if the orchestra did, you know, did some of the things, some of the hard things that needed to be done at the time, that there would be support there for the orchestra. And indeed, there was in the form of, you know, major funding, particularly from a number of donors, but especially from the Taylor family. I think whatever happens here, it's, you know, these things are never easy. I mean, you start from that premise. This is, you know, this is hard stuff. There are no easy answers. There are no magical answers. And at the end of the day, it ends up being some kind of, I think, you know, where you have to balance all of the aspects of this and do a little bit of everything, you know, some form of, you know, how do you ensure cost containment that's going to be reasonable? How do you get more money into the organization, more money to support the organization? But I will say this, that I do believe that that to focus on weeks is, I think, a little bit of a misnomer, because it does not, at the end of the day, determine how well the orchestra plays and what its reputation is. And there are multiple examples now of that around the country: Detroit Symphony, the Houston Symphony, of course, the St. Louis Symphony. And these are all very prominent, indeed, major orchestras.
But Tim Smith, it does affect how much money players in these orchestras are making, because the recent initial proposal by the board and management of the symphony here was to reduce their pay considerably. As I understand it from one of the members of the Players Committee, the St. Louis Symphony, which has cut its season back, as Fred mentioned, 9 or 10 weeks, is back up to about $100,000 a year base pay. That's considerably more than in Baltimore. I mean, in terms of this reputation, international and national reputational hit that might be taken if the orchestra here were to cut its season back, what do you think? Is there any magic to 52 weeks?
I don't know if it's magic exactly, but I think it means something to the players. This is an orchestra that for decades now, it seems like management gives with one hand and takes away with two. And now they're yanking away things. As I remember covering this back in the early part of the century, it seems not funny to say that, but you know what I mean, around there.
Early 2000s, yeah.
And they'd be all excited about a new contract, and they were finally going to start getting enough pay to start moving up closer to their peer orchestras. And it was inevitably something would go wrong, and something would, you know, they'd have to give back. I think when you've been through that history, and now you're suddenly being faced with what they see as a draconian method of approaching a financial problem, you're talking about destroying the confidence they have in the orchestra. And I'm not so sure that's entirely worth it if you can't, unless you have exhausted every other possibility. There's a lot of talk about the summer season, but this orchestra hasn't necessarily had great success with summertime. I understand that. That's a hard thing everywhere. But have they pursued every possible thing, maybe beyond Baltimore? I mean, I remember one year, half the orchestra toured the West Coast with, I think it was Linda Ronstadt, and the other half stayed and did the summer thing. Well, I don't know how often you can do something that weird or, you know, a little creative, but I wonder sometimes if there isn't another place for this orchestra in the country where there might be a festival that would like to have an orchestra of that stature. you can imagine if that brought Marin with them, how that could be a big deal. I mean, many of the big orchestras.
Marin also up the music director.
There are many other things that I'm not so sure. When you've exhausted every possibility of filling in whatever they consider to be the gaps, then I think there's a slightly stronger ground to tell people we're going to yank everything away from you that you've known for so long and that you fought so hard to get.
And Fred Bronstein, there's this narrative about symphony orchestras that they're failing. That there are problems. And as I mentioned at the top, there are 17 full-time professional orchestras now. That's down from 28, 29, 15 years ago. On the other hand, Greg Mulligan, one of the members of the Players Committee, has sent me a chart letting me know that the International Conference of Symphony Musicians lists several orchestras that have had steady increases in their pay. Alabama, Boston, Dallas, Detroit, Louisville, New York, Charlotte, Jacksonville, St. Louis. The pay has been going up. So here in Baltimore, if were pay to go down, that would be bucking a trend nationally, at least in these last few years.
So what I would say is that I absolutely am not one of those people and never have been one of those people that believes that orchestras are failing per se. I think that they are. I always tell people that it's a business that's not for the faint of heart. It is challenging. The margins are very thin, almost non-existent. And the business model is a very challenging business model. But having said that, absolutely there are places where St. Louis, the orchestra is, I would consider it to now be thriving, actually. And there are other examples of that as well. But what I would say is I think whatever happens with this, I hope that the approach that is taken is a long-term approach. I think a longer view of beyond just this next contract in terms of how do we, because everybody really does want the same thing. Everybody wants a great orchestra. They want it to be sustainable so that this isn't a conversation that's had every 2 to 3 years. And Tim is indeed right. There have been crises with this orchestra and other orchestras as well in the history. So my only point would be to say, think long term here. And I do think it's a little bit of a misnomer when you talk about what's a major orchestra and what's not a major orchestra, because I think that I go, look at what these orchestras are doing, and then I think make that determination about whether it fits that category.
Yeah, and Tim Smith, you spent 18 years writing about the Baltimore Symphony and other arts organizations in the town. Full disclosure, you even wrote about me a few times with the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. But when it comes to quality, the players here in Baltimore make the argument that were the Baltimore Symphony to have a reduced schedule and a reduced pay scale, it would not attract the best players in the country and that the quality of the orchestra would, in fact, diminish over time. What's your take on that?
It's very hard to argue against that thinking, although I know that management types will always say, oh, we can fill this orchestra tomorrow from graduates from Peabody or wherever, or Curtis. And to an extent, that's true. There are very talented young players, but that's not what an orchestra is made out of in a way. It's made out of something else, and it's all these intangible things that have to do with ensemble and inspiration and dedication and all that stuff, which you can't guarantee just because you're paying less and some hungry person is ready to take that job for that money. It's too big of a thing to risk, it seems to me. They've tried too hard. I think they're playing better now than at any time since I heard them in terms of consistency of technique and responsiveness and so on. And everybody can talk about interpretation. That's a whole other show, which would go on forever. But when it comes to what these guys can do night after night, week after week, it's very difficult to suddenly see that this makes some sense to, I know you've been doing so well, I'm glad you're doing so well, but now we're going to take away your pay, we're going to take away your benefits, we're going to take away everything. That's kind of a hard thing to say. Just because you think on the outside chance you can fill it this with other people if they get discouraged and leave. It takes too long to build what I think they have right now. It doesn't mean that everyone in an audience will know a difference, but I think in your heart you will begin to feel it, and certainly after a while.
Tim Smith is a former music critic for the Baltimore Sun. Fred Bronstein runs the Peabody Institute. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're talking about the Baltimore Symphony. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about a couple of opera companies here on Midday on Music. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. You can also follow us on the Facebook page at WYPR. We are streaming our conversation. So Fred Bronstein, you've gotten out of running the orchestra world, and now you're running people, you're training people to be in, among other places, orchestras. In terms of people, all talk about both management and players here and elsewhere. Talk about the importance of arts organizations like symphony orchestras to relate and resonate with their communities. Is it possible for an orchestra that at the moment only has one African American player to relate to a city that is majority Black? How important is diversity, and what are the challenges that symphony orchestras face in diversifying the people who are playing in their bands?
So it's a huge challenge, and I think that one of the real things about the world of classical music, quite frankly, is that it has not been historically a diverse place. And I think we pay the price, have paid the price, and continue to pay the price for that. You know, my feeling about diversity is that I don't think we can talk about diversity in this field. I'm not just talking about orchestras, I'm talking about classical music in general. I don't think we can talk about diversity as the right thing to do or good for quality. It's all of those things. It's much more than that, though. It is an existential question. Because when you look at audiences today and the challenge with attracting audiences generally, you know, more and more competition, harder and harder to do. We know that our audience declines. They're not fatal, but they're challenged. And I would say that when you look at the changing demographics in this country, we're now 2/3 white, 1/3 non-white country. That's going to flip literally within 30 to 40 years. And so if we want to think about expanding audiences, we have to think about this from the perspective of expanding and changing the face of the performers on the stage. We're not going to be able to do, you know, get broader audiences and more diverse audiences without doing that. That's where things like what Peabody's doing with its Tuned In program, and, you know, we're very focused as a strategic pillar on diversity at the school in terms of building underrepresented minority faculty and building our underrepresented minority student body. It's a big part of what we're focused on right now, because it has to start in our place before it can get to the orchestra.
And Tim Smith, the League of American Symphony Orchestras, has done several studies about this. They've been thinking about diversity with various levels of intensity for 30 years. And even after fellowship programs and programs that are designed to increase the number of players of color, the percentages are still incredibly low. In some places, it's, you know, well below 2%. As I mentioned, you know, Esther Mellon, God bless her, the cellist here in the orchestra, is the only African-American in the whole band at the moment. In terms of things like ORCIDS or the now erstwhile relationship that the BSO had with the Soulful Symphony, Darren Atwater's organization, which is 98% African-American and people of color, they're going to be in residence at the Meriwether Post Pavilion starting this summer. How does ORCIDS work into a long-term plan to diversify the BSO?
Well, they're trying to think of exactly what Fred's talking about, the future. They're trying to bring to an audience of, in this case, maybe underprivileged students who have little exposure, hoping that by picking up an instrument, learning stuff, having exposure to an interaction with players from the BSO, that they will develop at the very minimum an appreciation of that art form. But some of them, and they've already done so, they're going off to, you know, Interlaken, the very fine music camp. They're going off to schools to study seriously music. They've been at this long enough now to actually see the fruits of this. So that's an incremental change. My problem with orchestras, not just here, but everywhere, is that there is, unless you make it your determination from the top, and it comes down as we are going to be diverse no matter what. And that means you go through your programming and you start saying, wait a minute, we've played this damn Mozart thing and this too many times. Let's see what we can find. And, you know, right now, at this very moment, every orchestra, management, administrator, they should be running out and buying the just re-released set on Sony of the famous, Black Composer series that was released by Sony in the mid-70s, which it's now back on CD with all the original covers and so on. If you don't know that there's Black, you know, music written, classical music by Black composers, there's something wrong with you if you're running an orchestra in the United States. Of course, I have a problem.
So it's a programming issue, among other things.
That's just the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you don't even acknowledge the existence, we're in this renaissance of women composers getting much more attention than they were, and orchestras are going wild around the country and around the world.
And women conductors.
Yes, but it's fascinating to watch how they suddenly, the Philadelphia Orchestra, I think, was the one that released a season with nothing, and all of a sudden they were so shamed, and, you know, it's like the Twitter storm and the whole bit.
Yep.
Now there are female composers on that program. Well, we haven't seen quite the same thing with African-American composers, and the needs to. You've got George Walker, Hale Smith, William Grant Still, Coleridge Taylor, Jose White.
And is that gonna result, I mean, those are all good things, those are great composers, but is that going to result in bigger ticket sales and
no.
better fundraising?
That shouldn't be why you do it.
Because that's the thing. That's exactly the point. If that's the reason to do it, that's the wrong reason.
Sometimes you have to do something because it's the right thing to do. The BSO did have three fellowships for musicians of color, and that worked. Then I understand the funding went out or something happened.
Mellon Foundation, and they didn't want to get involved with an orchestra that didn't have a solid contract,
But I do believe that while those may not drive ticket sales, I do believe that communities recognize and they pay attention to efforts. And I think that, you know, where it becomes really important is to be able to say you are doing this broader kind of programming. And again, I bring it back to the folks that are on the stage, though, because I think that, I mean, we're now up to over 10% of our faculty are URM, underrepresented minorities, 13% of our students. It's about double what the national average is, and we're going to continue to focus
on
this.
And
the conductor of your orchestra is Joseph Young, an African-American man.
Who came through the BSO program. I got a little boost from having that fellowship there.
So this issue of really diversifying the involvement, and this starts at a very early age. You know, you have to find, you know, gifted young students that have ability, identify them, train them, and get them into the conservatories and the music schools. Because if they're going to have any chance of getting to the orchestras, it has to start there. And so I think this is this is not a choice anymore. This is essential to the field. It's about the survival of the field, actually. I would go so far as to say
that. And let me say, if you can't get players, if that becomes a little longer range problem, when's the last time at the BSO you saw a soloist or conductor of color? These people exist. They're all over the place.
Well, soloists are,
except when they're singing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to have Porgy and Bess. So of course, they can always count on that.
Right.
And you can count on a few other appearances. But I can't remember the last time I saw a pianist or a violinist or a cellist. They exist. And it's the mentality. I think what happens with a lot of orchestras is they get so used to the same booking agents and the same people they have long-time mm-hmm. relationships with, and it's just sort of a laziness. And I've occasionally been asked for recommendations, and I remember early on, I always took great umbrage at this, and I gave them a great suggestion one time of somebody who did orchestral arrangements of gospel and conducted the hell out of it and knew how to make this. That was one of the best concerts I've ever heard when I was working in Florida. I passed on this when I was asked out of the blue. You know, never heard a word, never seen. Yeah. To this day, I don't think they've done any program call like that. So what happened to the MLK concert? What happened to the Young Gifted and Black series? What happened to going out into the churches? They used to do all of that when I got here at that turn of that century. All of those things disappeared. And I don't know. You can't just keep blaming money. It's because somebody decided it wasn't as important of the higher priority. Yeah, I think
again,
in a city
it could have
like
been
this,
that they were thinking, oh, this will raise our fundraising or raise our tickets. Again, that shouldn't be the impetus. So, Fred Bronstein, we're running out of time here. But over the last 10 or 12 years, the Maryland legislature has given supplemental funding to the BSO about five times. They're talking about a $3.2 million boost that would cover the next two years. Is that going to be enough? I mean, if does that mean in 2 years we're going to revisit this whole problem again? I mean, and the other issue here is if it goes to the BSO, does that mean it's not going to some of the other arts institutions around the state?
Well, first of all, my understanding is that this funding is separate funding. It is not coming from the Maryland Council on the Arts, which is really the primary funding agent to performing arts and the arts generally around the state. I would say that to answer your question about the $3.2 million, I think it's important that this happen, but I would also say that it's very important that the institution use this as an opportunity to think about how are they going to solve some of these strategic issues. If all it becomes is an extension of the negotiating, conversation, the contract conversation, I don't think that will be productive. If they embrace it as an opportunity to think about the long-term strategic objectives and how do you solve some of these problems, I think it'll be very helpful.
Fred Bronstein is the dean of the Peabody Institute. Tim Smith is the former classical music critic for the Baltimore Sun. He blogs about music at bytimsmith.com. Bandcamp.com. Thank you both, gentlemen. I appreciate it. We will continue this conversation later.
Thanks for having us.
By the way, this weekend at the BSO, Jack Everly leads the BSO Pops in a program called Cirque Goes to Hollywood. It features troupe Vertigo with acrobats and aerialists and jugglers, plus a terrific singer in Kenjay. Performances are tonight and tomorrow night, and again on Sunday afternoon at the Meyerhoff. Our website has linked to details, wypr.org/midday. Coming up, Midday on Music continues with a look at two opera companies with performances this weekend in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.